This is News in Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, more on the future of New Orleans. How will race play a role? And the NAACP says Republicans are using the IRS for a political witch hunt. Joining us today to discuss these topics and more from our bureau in New York City, Marcelo Suarez Orozco. He's professor of globalization and education and also the co-director of immigration studies at New York University. Laura Washington of the Chicago Sun-Times. She's a columnist there. She joins us from our Chicago bureau. And at member station WGBH, Callie Crossley. She's a social and cultural commentator on the television show Beat the Press, seen in the Boston area. All right, folks, let's get into a little bit of what we've been discussing already on this program, Laura Washington, and that is, in many people's minds, a surprising victory of Ray Nagin and people questioning how much race really played a role in all of this. How much do you believe that race was the deciding factor for most?
I think if you look at the breakout of the vote, it's clear that race did play a role. But I think the significant thing here is that, as has been mentioned earlier, Mr. Nagin was written off primarily because of the assumption that the white vote would desert him, as it did in the primary. And he did get a significant amount of white voters, some people say because they saw him as actually more conservative than Mr. Landrieu, but some people because I think they're just much more comfortable with a businessman type as he is and also as an incumbent. So I think this is an opportunity to get beyond race. Race may have played a role, but to get beyond race and try to unify the city, which is one of the things that he has promised.
Marcelo, what of the idea, and so many people talk about this in terms of the future of New Orleans, if you are an entrepreneur, one has to look at that city and suggest that there are going to be a burgeoning number of opportunities for you to make money, build businesses, etc. Ray Nagin is going to have to find a way to make sure that people of color share in all of this. It won't necessarily be easy.
Indeed. There's a tremendous opportunity here, and the opportunity will be realized once the infrastructure is back in place, and really once the political class gets its act together in terms of moving forward an agenda for the rebirth of this one of our truly great cities, a city that has given the world so much. So yes, a lot of opportunities, but also a huge challenge for the political class, for the business class, for the citizens of New Orleans.
Callie?
Yeah, I'm interested in the fact that the gap between the two of them was so narrow, 5,400 votes. So, you know, I'm one of the people that was quite surprised that he made the primary and that he won. But I thought to myself afterwards when I heard that he won, you know, maybe those of us who are from the outside really need to pay more attention to the people who are on the ground. What I came away with from him to some large extent was some of the wacky stuff that he said that just didn't make any sense to me, and he seemed to be not together. But obviously, the folks who made it their business to get there from hundreds of miles away felt that he had their future in his hands, and that's who they wanted to do that. So we have to pay attention to that. I'm very curious about the 20% of the white voters who signed up for him because they are labeled as conservative, and I'm not quite certain what that means in this context. So it'll be very interesting to see how it all plays out. It's very interesting.
Here's what's interesting. We had Ray Nagin on, I guess, last week it was, and it seems as though in those last few days he did find his footing, was more self-assured. I should say in the last few weeks was more self-assured. But Callie raises an interesting point, and that is so many people watch this from outside, from so many miles away, and really watched it through sound bites. There was a lot of the community that found the Ray Nagin that the media tried to portray as a loose cannon endearing, in that they thought, hey, here's a guy really standing up and fighting for us.
I think that's absolutely the image, and I suspect that, you know, that is his personality and his style, to be sort of off the cuff and rambunctious. But I think it's also a calculated strategy in terms of appealing to Black voters in particular, disenfranchised voters who are tired of hearing rhetoric and tired of hearing about promises. It really worked for him. He did tone that rhetoric down toward the end, and I think that is why he was able to capture that white vote that Callie was wondering about. But at the same time, the folks that he's been speaking for since the hurricane hit had been hearing him, and they wanted to make sure that they kept it in his hands. I also think he used a racial appeal that he did it on a low-key level, but he talked about keeping the seat. Now, remember, there hasn't been a white mayor in New Orleans for almost 30 years, and he appealed to black voters, we don't want to lose his seat, and I think it worked.
All right, Callie, let me get you to turn to our next topic, and that is we're hearing from the NAACP, which is suggesting that several Republican members of Congress sent letters to the IRS after Julian Bond's infamous now speech where he largely criticized President Bush's policy, this during the 2004 presidential election. And we saw subsequently the IRS start to look into the tax-exempt status of the organization based on the speech being, quote, too political. The group is suggesting that senators including Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, Susan Collins of Maine, and Strom Thurmond of South Carolina were among those who really pushed the IRS to start what essentially they're calling a smear campaign. We don't know that this is the case yet. But it seems to me that all of this is political and smacks of hypocrisy, perhaps even on both sides.
Well, that's absolutely true. We discussed on this program, if you go back and pull up the tape, that the minute he said that this was going to come back to haunt him, meaning Julian Bond, that there were already folks saying at that moment, oh, we will not let that stand. And isn't this a nonprofit organization? And who is he, you know, to say these things? And I guess some of it will come down to whether or not he can say, I said what I said as a private citizen or who happens to be leading the NAACP. But it is very clear that when you have constituents, or so they say, constituents writing saying you need to call the IRS and look into this because what is the NAACP doing in this way? It's supposed to be nonprofit. It's supposed to be non-political. Now, on the other hand, part of what Julian Bond has to do to represent black folks or persons of color is to say what they've been saying. And they were saying long before Natalie Maines of Dixie Chicks, you know, there's some issues here around this war and some issues here around this election, and I'm going to raise them. So I don't know how, I mean, I think it's going to come down to a very fine line and really parsing out exactly what he said and how it could be interpreted from either on the private citizen side as opposed to representing the organization.
Marcelo, not that we haven't historically seen this before, but one has to take a good long look at the body of Congress if, in fact, you're starting to use groups like the IRS for political gain.
Yes, we, in fact, have a long history. And as was said earlier, I think this will really be defined as a function of what was exactly said and how does that line up with the not-for-profit, non-political status issue. On the other hand, I think that we have to always be very, very careful of the use, the political use of instruments of government to silence what ought to be a very broad, a very transparent, a very engaged debate about the big issues of our time.
Here's what's very interesting in terms of the catch-22 that the NAACP may find itself in. Particularly the younger generation has said for a long time they want this group to be more out front, more action-oriented versus reaction-oriented. And the idea that it's hard to do so if you are a nonprofit, yet if they were to turn and try to go on their own, the dollars that come in, particularly from African Americans, just aren't enough to sustain this group in any way, shape, or form where they could, in fact, fight the good fight.
Well, of course, the NAACP is one of our longtime traditional civil rights groups, and there are plenty of newcomers on the scene, groups that are indeed being run and orchestrated by younger people that are more community-oriented. Yes, I think there's a middle ground here. The NAACP is becoming increasingly irrelevant. It's old, it's stodgy, it's bureaucratic. And there,
you really
there are
believe
things
they're
that they
increasingly
can
becoming irrelevant, though?
Absolutely.
That, I mean, you hear that all the time.
Absolutely. When I look at a city like Chicago, you know, there are NAACP chapters all over the Chicago metropolitan area. I never hear from them. I never see them out there being active. It's, again, as you said, they've always been reactive. And I think that the younger folks talk about not donating to these organizations. They're not even going to pay any attention to these organizations. But I think this whole issue of the IRS investigation is kind of a red herring as well. IRS is not going to come in and revoke, you know, the NAACP's tax exempt status. It's just not going to happen. It very rarely does. And it's going to be an investigation. It's going to be a slap on the hand. It might cost the NAACP a little bit of money and fines. But I think it's much more important that they remain outspoken, and they can do that despite the IRS.
It's interesting to see that discussion in terms of the relevancy of this and other organizations, civil rights organizations. You know, there are those who suggest that they're just not up to speed anymore. But there are others who would say, if they were not here, what would be the trouble?
You know, I have to say that I hear what Laura is saying, but I think you could break it down into two parts. Maybe on the ground, what Laura is saying is I don't see them out there. But certainly when the big issues happen, they are the first ones to file suit, to raise concerns. So maybe it's become more of a, if you will, kind of corporate nonprofit in that they have to look at the global issues and stand up and say that. And I see that quite a bit. So people, I don't know that they can appreciate the work that is still being done by the NAACP if they're only looking for what's happening on the ground. It may have evolved to an organization that does, that really takes on some of the larger issues in the way that it can because it understands how those systems work. And some of the grassroots organizations but run by young people do not. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. I think we need to have both. The only other point I would raise is that we're going to see with the IRS and looking at churches and whether churches and faith-based organizations have overstepped their bounds with regard to status and trying to mix it up in terms of what is appropriate from an IRS standpoint. So I wonder if they may try to, you know, sort of link what's happening here with the NAACP on the one side with what's also going on in a big debate going on among churches, because there are some IRS probes going on there, too.
Yeah. All right. Let's take a look at this. Surprise, surprise, a little confusion if you were just reading this from Capitol Hill once again. Should English be the national language of America, or should it simply be common and unifying language? We saw two resolutions put forth in the U.S. Senate. The first, suggesting it as a national language, was voted 63-34 up. The second, as a common and unifying language, 58-39 up. Professor, when we take a look at this, and we should note that the White House, the Bush administration, supports both measures, there are those who are saying, once again, why this now, and is this yet another move to say we're tired of the, quote, Browning of America?
This is symbolic politics. This is in the context of the Senate debating new immigration legislation. English is a predominant language, not only in the United States, but increasingly worldwide. The English language is at no risk today from any other language. Those who are afraid of Spanish becoming an enduring second language in the United States should keep in mind that Germans brought their language, German immigrants did, Italians brought their language, Japanese immigrants brought their language to the United States. And one of my colleagues at Harvard once said, the U.S. is a cemetery for languages. All of these languages were pushed aside and English reigned supreme. This is symbolic politics. This is a non-issue. Immigrants today, Spanish-speaking immigrants, Creole-speaking immigrants, immigrants from all over the world are learning English faster and better, by the way, that immigrants learned English 100 years ago.
So I'm sorry, Marcelo, go
ahead. This is really kind of a political posturing.
All right, Laura and Callie, with about a minute for you both. Laura, let me start with you. Here's what's interesting to me. Throughout all of this, the interesting point is America remains one of the few countries that is not bilingual.
And I think that is a big problem. I agree with what Marcelo says about the speed and the importance of which it's important to learn the English language. But I think it's also important to realize that we're in a global world. And that is, and we should be celebrating and reinforcing the need for bilingualism in this country, especially among, you know, especially in the education area. Look at what's happening in our, in terms of our problems in the Middle East. One of the big obstacles to us addressing the growth of Islam and its influence is that nobody speaks Arabic outside the Middle East. We can't even get translators. The United States can't get translators to work with folks, you know, that we're dealing with in Iraq right now. So it's more important than ever to be bilingual, multilingual.
I would agree with that. I would also say that this has been used as sort of kind of a battering ram for folks. I know people say, well, it's not really racist. We're looking at a broader situation. We are American. It should be English. But in fact, you know, that's exactly how it's being used, because we can't appreciate that globalization that Laura has said that we need to be engaged in. I would also say that even though Alberto Gonzalez has said that the language, whether national or common, makes no legal difference, I've heard from some activist groups that if it's national, it does make a difference. With regard to what some organizations and institutions and how they have to respond. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
All right. Marcelo, Laura, and Callie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.